Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. It is December 13th, 2014. Well, it feels like, even though it feels like it should be Friday the 13th instead of Saturday the 13th, or maybe yesterday should have been Friday the 13th instead of Friday the 12th, with the way things were going for me, but even so, here I am, and I'm doing a show today, although it's a little bit surprising that I'm managing to do it. I've got a few ailments with my computer, my downloading system, so that's been causing me a lot of headache in the last 15 hours or 20 hours or so. But in any case, I'll tell you that the music program I hope to have today just did not come together because of these technical problems and other kind of problems, which left me with no access to my downloads from my website. And I have no idea how to correct that, so I have to get somebody in here to do it for me. I know it can be corrected, but I couldn't figure it out. I spent a lot of time last night messing around with it and just got very frustrated. So I'm doing today, on today's show, what some things that I thought about doing on Monday, this coming Monday. Therefore, the radio schedule that I have worked out for this Christmas season, New Year season, I'm going to tell you about it right now. On Monday, this coming Monday, the 15th, there might be a program, but it's doubtful. It's quite doubtful. And there might be a program on Monday, the 29th of December. I'm not sure. But I am sure there will be a January 1st Table Talk program. So from today until then, that's quite a break. But I'm happy to be able to take it. I'm going to take it. And I have a whole slew of things to take care of and put my attention on. I really am into my end of the year and first of the year reassessment of my priorities, like what I've called, thought of as New Year's resolutions. But this year it's more than New Year's resolutions, more like how am I going to keep all this up, and when am I going to face the fact that I can't keep it all up without destroying the rest of my life. So when am I going to deal with this? And I usually wait until things get to a pretty bad stage before I do. So there are things I need to do, and I've already gotten started with some new personal projects. I don't mean projects that would be competitive with this personal project, which is prime for me, but personal things, health things to do with health, which are necessary, and things to do with just taking care of the nuts and bolts of my life, which I keep ignoring and don't keep putting off. I keep saying, you know, just managing to keep up with things while I'm getting back to my programs and articles and posts and so on, and it's just not working anymore. So things happen, maybe like what happened yesterday, that just pushed me to do some, you know, to let go of some things, to let go a little bit. So, but I'm not going to let go altogether. I'm just going to see maybe some of these things that I take care of in the next 2 weeks will really get going on their own in a good way. But I don't think I have to cut back on what I'm doing. Probably won't be doing three radio programs a week. I never should have thought that I could do that for a long period of time. But once I get started doing something, it's hard for me to stop. I kind of feel like I'm giving up something I shouldn't. But we'll see how it goes. So I might say a little bit more about that at the end of the show. I meant to talk about it at the end, but here I've talked about it in the beginning. There probably isn't anything more for me to say about it. So I want to move on then with the program. And I want to thank Brett from Michigan for a donation that I just now received. Thank you very much, Brett. And also thank Dimitar from Canada for a donation that came a week or so ago. Donations have been far and few between lately, and I don't expect, since I'm going to be off the air for the next couple of weeks, even though I'll have probably be posting some things on my website and things of that nature, I don't expect it's going to improve much. So, you know, I just will say just a word. I'm not complaining. I can get along all right. But for those people who sometimes like to, of course, we all have our detractors, I guess. I'm a detractor for some other people. So, I don't really feel like I'm being picked on or anything. But it's pretty idiotic to say about me that I'm in it for the money. I just find that really hilarious. It costs me money. It's been costing me money all along. Once in a while, I get something pretty big from someone. But what I call pretty big is probably not what other people think of as pretty big. It is wonderful, but that doesn't happen regularly. And I have quite a bit of expenses involved in all of this. And now, you know, I have to add up the expense of my time, you know, my health, and all the time that I spend that I take away from things, other things in my life, which costs me money because I'm not maintaining my life in the way my house. I've done better on I've done some work on my house, but my car, my paying my bills. Sometimes I get late fees. I have to pay late fees because I forget. I've set it down. I've got covered up. I've forgotten about it. So these kind of things bother me because I don't like to be out of control. I like to be in control, and I don't want to imagine myself getting to a point of no return. And I certainly, since I live alone, that's not a good idea. So anyway, those are some of the things that I'm dealing with, I'm thinking about, and working with here at the end of this year of 2014 as we begin a new year of 2015. And so there will probably be some changes, and I hope some of them for me will be for the better as far as some of the problems I've just talked about. So to start out with today's program, I want to talk about what I've been seeing as far as news stories go about the black community, the Negro or African American community, and their response, their continuing response to the Ferguson grand jury verdict. And then since that one, the one in New York for the man who died from a chokehold, and then now every other one they can find and add to the number. And it gets to a point, it's at a point of absolute ridiculousness and what I'm calling insanity, because we're just dealing in the world today, in the U.S., in Europe, in Germany, in wherever else our people are, with absolute insanity as far as having a civilization that can continue on with any kind of looking after we people who are here, particularly we're looking after continuation of civilization. I don't see how civilization can continue under the pressures that we're under, and I don't think it will. And I don't see what can be done. I don't want to be just get on here and get negative, you know, be a doomsayer. But boy, it doesn't look good. Now, let me just go over some of these things, and many of you are probably familiar with. But just the other day, I was so surprised to see this story, that black congressional staffers from the Capitol, Capitol workers, they call them, got together and posed and are, you know, standing up for protesting the Ferguson grand jury ruling. And they're on the House steps. They're in Washington, D.C. They work for the government. They work at the Capitol. And there was about 100 of them. And they're all coming out in favor of, or in protest, against the police in Ferguson, Missouri, and the grand jury verdict. And here's what they say. They held up their hands, you know, in this hands-up protest stance that they're all taking on. And They listened to the Senate chaplain, a black man, read a little prayer for those who died, who couldn't speak, can't now speak for themselves, and they couldn't speak or breathe for themselves, he said, referring to the Eric Garner in New York. And he said, may we not forget that in our history, injustice has often been maintained because good people failed to promptly act. And he had these 100 people. Well, I'm not going to read any more of that, but that's one thing that I thought was really inappropriate, totally inappropriate for these people, congressional staffers and so on. I don't think they're not janitors there. They're people who work in a responsible position for congressmen, and they're coming out like this in this racial, but they call it justice. Well, on top of that, a black member of Congress named Hank Johnson has started a petition and is trying to get, well, I guess he's trying to get 20,000 signatures, and right now it says online that there's over 16,000 signatures there, and it reads this. He says, in the wake of the killings of unarmed black men and boys and the outrageous failure to prosecute their killers, tell Congress to reform the system that holds cops accountable. Cops. And he writes, dear members of Congress, support Representative Hank Johnson's Grand Jury Reform Act, which would require a special prosecutor in cases of police killings in places where law enforcement receives federal funding. Please co-sponsor this critical legislation today. Well, if, you know, the grand jury system has been in force since this country started, as far as I know, and it's worked very well. Nobody has complained about grand juries for the most part, unless they're too liberal in favor of the of criminals. But there's a reason for grand juries being secret and all of that. And these black people think that because something doesn't if they're found guilty of what they do and they're not released and they're not let off, or the people or authorities and law enforcement who end up having to shoot a black person in the course of dealing with them or arresting them is should not be allowed to do that, you know. And then you have to have put these people on trial. There's a little bit more here that will explain this, but this is very bad for this country. It's only something that emotionally motivated and people like what's his name, that can't think of his name right now, Al Sharpton, people like Al Sharpton dream up for what they consider getting more and more power for blacks, for the black lobby, you might say. And you know that it's Jews are behind that, helping African Americans do this. They wouldn't be able to, and they're behind them with money. How does they have all this money? How does Al Sharpton get all the money for busing people? Now he's busing a bunch of people to Washington for a big protest rally today. This fact is probably taking place right now. And here's, and you know he's got to be getting money from Jews. And I think some of these organizations even get federal money because they're minority. They're supposedly made up of minorities. But this is a terrible idea. Absolutely irresponsible to be messing around with the laws of this country that have been in place for so many years just because of that they want black people to not be punished for all the robbing, looting, killing, slaughtering, rioting that they do. They don't want them to have to. If they get hurt or shot in the process of that, they don't want that policeman to get away with it. They want to prosecute him. So let's look at this next story here. It's something written by the National Journal, entitled this bill would make grand jury proceedings public. Okay, this the bill that they want, that Johnson wants, this black man, Hank Johnson, Representative Hank Johnson, it would shake up the current grand jury system, which he calls fundamentally broken. Fundamentally broken. It's not broken. But, you know, see, that's the words they use. When it comes to prosecuting, it's broken when it comes to prosecuting police officers. Rather than taking place in secret, as grand jury hearings do now, the process would become open to the public. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine what a circus that would become? And here's a quote from Johnson. He says, passage of this bill would help restore trust in our justice system. Well, it only restored the trust of black people who don't have any trust anyway. No matter what you did, they wouldn't trust it unless they were in charge and it was all blacks on there running the show. And even then they would decide that Whitey was causing some blacks not to go along with what the general blacks wanted. But he says this would help restore trust in our justice system while ensuring a fair process for everybody. Yeah, but it's stupid because it says the proposed bill would change the system in three major ways. First, when a police officer uses deadly force that ends in the death of a civilian, the state would convene a public hearing in front of a judge to determine whether or not the officer should be charged with the crime. And there you'd have all these blacks outside with their signs and screaming and yelling and getting, you know, in front of the TV cameras, protesting and calling for what they wanted to the public, the judge, to determine instead of going to a grand jury. And this means that if this actually was put into practice, which I'm sure it will not be, but it means that no police officer would ever use deadly force because he's going to be brought up in this public hearing and questioned and all, and he might be charged with a crime. So why should he take such chances as that? And, you know, grand juries have enough sensible people on them to understand that. You can't hold a man guilty for doing his job the way he's been taught to do it. But these Negroes have no conception of what's good for everybody. They're just trained to think that they have grievances, and if they make enough noise about their grievances and do what their leaders tell them, that they might get something out of it. Now, the second change in the system would be the case against the police officer would be led by an independent special prosecutor appointed by the governor, removing the local prosecutors, who Johnson says can have a cozy relationship with police from the process. Now, you know, who has more cozy relationships and corrupt processes than black politicians? And black, whenever we've had black governors, black mayors, whatever, they're the most corrupt corrupt of all. But they want to put it in the federal jurisdiction. Well, this one would be at the state level. So the governor, who is a political, you know, who's always concerned with politics, would be having to decide who the special prosecutor was. And how often would the special prosecutor be a black person to make it sure that it was fair and there was no, you know, racism involved? So we would just be more and more putting black people in charge of our entire justice process. That's what they would like to do. They've got a big start on it already, and we see where it's leading and what's happening with what's been going on now. Even these things I'm just talking about right now is because there's a black attorney general and a black president, and he's appointing more black people into the justice process. And the final change would be that states would be required to follow the new rules or risk losing a chunk of federal funding. So, you know, if a state wanted to opt out of this, it would lose some federal funding. And by doing this federal funding business long time ago and making states pay, letting the federal government tax all kinds of things and handle all kinds of money that are raised in the state, and then handing the money back to the state, has caused the states to be at the mercy of the federal government. And, of course, the blacks have always depended on the federal government since the Civil War. They look to the federal government to be their champion and just to protect them from local government and even state government. So they just want to put more and more things that have to do with them in the hands of the feds. And Representative John Conyers, who's very well known, has been in Congress for ages, since he's, you know, all you have to have is a district to be a congressman. Not that much, and if you have a district of people who are like you, like he has a black New York district, well, they just vote him back in again and again and again and again, no matter what he does. Anyway, he's very pro-black, and so he's co-sponsored this ridiculous bill, but he should know better. It can't be good for his reputation as a responsible congressman to co-sponsor a bill like this. So that's just, you know, one aspect of one example of the kind of irresponsible insanity that is being perpetrated because of the allowing the Negro to get more in the past, also allowing the Jew to get more and more ability to get into government, to run for office, to appear to be respectable and capable of handling these jobs and so on in a fair way and representing their people. That is exactly where we end up, and it's going in that direction. What kind of a country is it that where you're going to have it run by low intelligence black people and have whites be subject to the rules and the laws that these people make? It looks very bad. Now, this protest today, thousands of demonstrators are to be there in Washington and New York to protest the killings, they say, the killings of unarmed black men by U.S. police and urge Congress to protect citizens. Boy. And I wanted to point out that they, in this the petition by Hank Johnson, it talks about police killings. As though when a policeman shoots someone in the course of his duty of protecting the public and what he's supposed to be doing, he's now a killer. You know, they're calling him a killer. Pretty soon they're going to be calling him murderers. Well, they have done that in certain instances. Here it is. It says they're killers. He's calling the killings of unarmed black men and boys and the failure to prosecute their killers, saying that the policeman, in this case it was Darren Wilson in Ferguson, who shot this monster black guy that was attacking him. They're calling him a killer, you see. That's how they use this language and get away with it, because it's a congressional application for Congress to support this, to turn it into a bill. But it's terrible language to be used. So this protest today in Washington and New York is led by Reverend Al Sharpton and his National Action Alliance. And he's got all these buses, and I saw, you know, some pictures of these people getting on the bus and then inside the bus. Boy, they were packed in there. Who could stand to be in that bus with them, with all those Negro people packed in there like that? It looked like a horrible situation even for them. But they're just people that get paid something to get on that bus and go through the demonstration and then be taken back home again. They're not people that mind this, that being packed in a bus with one another like that. as long as they get a little money for it and think that they're going to, you know, get whitey a little bit. So it's all about the lack of criminal charges from grand juries. So these people are questioning what a grand jury does, and if a grand jury doesn't find in their favor the way they wanted to, you know how long in Ferguson they were threatening out there on the streets and all over that you better not come back, you better not acquit this policeman, you better come back with some charges to go to a regular jury. You know, and so they have the right to do that, and they're allowed, and naturally, as I said, the Jews help them, and then the Jews write it all up in their newspapers in the way they want, and so many people still are taken in by that, and generally the leftists are, because you see how many white people they have on their side. It shouldn't be a single white person who would ever support any of this, but they do. So they say they need to do more than just talk. They need legislative action, and they, you know, that's what Sharpton says in a statement. Boy. All right. Now the next thing I want to go on to is the protest against Islamification or Islamization of Europe, and particularly going strong. That's going strong in Germany, which is encouraging. But the efforts against it are going to grow, become stronger, until these people are going to, who would dare to go out there and join these protests on Mondays, will be grave danger of all sorts of repercussions from the state. The only way around that is for them to grow to an even larger numbers, like they got to 10,000, 50,000, and 100,000. You know, they need numbers like that in order to make it clear that this is a popular movement of the people, that this is the people, and the people don't want it. Because the things that these politicians, these German leaders are saying are really atrocious in my mind. They're just terrible. So here's some of them. A spokeswoman for Chancellor Angela Merkel said Friday that the government condemned the anti-Islam marches in the strongest terms. Now, just that is, to me, a horrible shock. And not a shock, but a horrible thing for the leader of a country to say about her own people. You know, these are not, you know, these are ordinary people. And there was 10,000 of them. And instead of even giving a single word that she understood that they are upset about things. She doesn't even do that. She just came right out and denounced them in the strongest terms. They have no right to march like that. They're bad. She said, there is no place in Germany for Islamophobia or anti-Semitism, hatred of foreigners or racism. That's what she said. And she pledged decisive government action against any form of hatred. Brother, there's so much hatred against Germans, but that doesn't bother her. This woman, every once in a while, I see her as against other leaders, and I get a little, I think, well, she's the German, you know. I get a little, not good feeling, but a little warm, maybe. But boy, this has really turned me off. She is simply the leader of, she's simply in place there by the globalists. She is a globalist. I mean, her whole, she has, whether she wants to or not, but she is, she agrees to carry out the globalist agenda. So their intention is to bring all these other races and religions into Germany and do it in spite of what the people want. They don't care what the people want. They can pretend like they do, but here she's not even pretending. And what's important in conjunction with this is that at the same time there are these stories that the United States is on this big battle against the ISIS, the ISIS Islamic State fighters, and now we're going all out for attacking these because they're fanatics and they're extremely murderous. They're extremely violent, and they're beheading and killing people right and left. They are. It's a terrible organization, but it's Islamic, and we recognize this is these are people are our enemies. Of course, the United States rules over what goes on in Germany. Germany is just goes along with whatever the United States wants and believes and takes it on for themselves. So at the same time, they want to bring more Muslims into Europe, not only Germany, but everywhere. And so it clearly doesn't fit together. It's clearly contradictory in the worst terms. It's clearly a form of insanity, really, that you would be fighting some of them and welcoming others, thinking that, well, these are the fanatics and these others are nice, agreeable, peace-loving people. And we need them for our workforce because we need their youth, and they have a lot of children. We need those young people to be growing up in Germany because our population is decreasing of true Germans. This is a phony argument. For one thing, in Japan, they don't allow any non-Japanese immigration into their country, and they have an aging population, and it is a problem for them, but they're dealing with it, and they're still the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world. They're not going down the tubes. So this idea that we need to import people, that non-Germans and particularly people from other races and religions like that is just doesn't hold up. It really there should be more arguments against it. There should be more people pointing out that it's not a good argument that they're making for this, because you're just asking for trouble. And the German people are getting a little bit of a voice here, and they're realizing that this is really something that's bringing on their own doom. Is bringing an end to the Germany that they thought they lived in, that they've known. And it's not only old people out there, it's a lot of young people. Everybody's getting it. They don't like it. They don't want it. And finally, they've found a way to get enough of them to go out there. And hopefully it will grow. But does the government of Germany care about these people and what they think and how they feel? No. And they want to make it, they've always made it plain that they're going to say what's going to happen. And if you disagree, you're going to be marginalized in one way or another, and you might be arrested. But they've got greater numbers now than I think they've ever had, and one can only hope that they get bigger. Now, here's some of the things that these people that run Germany have said. First, they have to tell you that Germany is a country haunted by its history of Nazi terror and the Holocaust. Well, there was no Nazi terror, except in the eyes of the Jews, except for Jews. And they always make out that whatever happened to Jews happened to everybody, but it didn't. And then this leader of this movement, Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of Europe, I thought there was something here by him. But Chancellor Angela Merkel's spokeswoman said Friday that the government condemned all anti-Islam marches, and that, I already read this part, the Interior Minister, Thomas de Maizière of Germany, has said there is no danger of an Islamization of Germany, particularly not in Saxony, where foreign-born residents make up just 2.2% of the population. See, he picks out Saxony, which is in East Germany, where there's the least of the influx of these foreigners go, because it's the least economically and technologically and industrially developed. So they're not heading for places like that in Saxony. They're not heading for Dresden particularly, where these demonstrations are going on. But the people of Dresden are willing to go out and protest against it for all of Germany, because some of the people in the West are not willing to do that. And they go to places like Hamburg, Berlin, and Munich too, but mostly those first two, and other places like that. where the number is much higher, but he wants to say, oh, well, there's no danger of this. They just make up 2.2% of the population. That's probably not even accurate because he's probably only talking about those who, well, he says foreign-born residents, okay. But it always starts this way. See, like in the United States with our immigration laws, it starts out, they say, oh, we're going to hold it at this number and there's nothing to worry about, there's no danger, the percentage is so small. And then before you know it, it's growing and you can't get the laws passed. You can't get things changed back. And then presidential action takes over, like what Obama is doing. And they allow things that even Congress won't vote for and make executive orders and so on. And in one way or the other, they keep increasing the number of foreigners in your land until you are a minority. Then we have this justice minister in Germany, Heiko Maas, said, "We can't stay silent when xenophobic sentiments are being aimed at people who have lost everything and come to us seeking help." Who knows if these people have lost everything? And what a way to put it. All the people in the world who have lost things and come to us seeking help, we can't turn them away. And we can't be xenophobic about it. As though those people who are protesting against them, against their coming, are unfeeling, cruel, hateful people. That's where the hate comes in. And they start talking about hate, making out that you hate people when you're only trying to preserve your own land and your own language and your own culture and your own for your children. And he says, we must make clear that these demonstrations do not represent a majority. Now notice how he says that. We must make clear. They have to make sure that nobody observing this or reading about him would think that the majority of Germans are unhappy about this immigration and especially these refugees that they're allowing in, who are most of whom will never leave. And they'll have children, a lot of children, and they won't leave either. And it probably is the majority. It's a majority of people, of Germans, who don't like it, who don't approve of it, if they would tell the truth. But, of course, when they ask them in polls, they word the questions in such a way that they get the answer that they want, because the typical German is not ready to answer otherwise, no matter how the question is worded, because he knows that he doesn't want it, but he answers what the wording is, and then they make it out that the people don't mind what's happening. But they do mind, and I think that it probably is a majority, and they're very clear that they're very careful and even saying it, that we have to make sure that nobody thinks that this is a majority of Germans wanting this. We have to make out that this is just a small group of xenophobic, far-right haters left over from the Nazi regime and neo-Nazis, etc., which it is not. Now, the protesters on their side, they are saying that their aim is to prevent their country from being overrun by dangerous jihadists and foreigners who refuse to integrate. And that's exactly true. They're not integrating. It wasn't so long ago Merkel announced that the multiculturalism was not working because the Turks were not integrating, were not being assimilating. They're not willing to assimilate. But what her answer for that was to make special programs to teach them, you know, for them to go to for free, to teach them to speak German and other kind of programs for the children in school to teach them German and other kind of things like that, rather than say we're not going to allow so many of you in anymore, because her absolute avowed position is that there's not going to be any stop to bringing especially Turks and other people, Muslim people, into Germany on the pretext that they need workers, that the aging German population needs all kinds of, well, one thing is healthcare workers and workers for people in nursing homes and so on. They turn to these people for those jobs. You know, don't everybody has these older people, maybe they don't all have children, but a lot of them would have children, but this trend toward children having their own life and not looking after their parents, but turning them over to agencies, not necessarily to the state, but to these private nursing homes and so on, who they tell themselves give better care and good care to their parents, and they pay for it, and they'd rather work and have their own life, and therefore you need all these workers. There was something in here said for 167, I don't know if I have this right, for 167 people, elderly people in a nursing home, it required 100 employees to take care of them. That's how many people it requires for these old people. So, but that's, you know, that could be worked out differently. I know there are a lot of unemployed Germans, and you're just going to have to, you'd have to force them to do work they didn't particularly want to do. And maybe they weren't going to be that good at it, but it's your own people, and your own people are going to depend on their own people. That needs to be brought out in us, that if we don't care about our own people, then our own people are going to suffer for that, because we're not going to turn them over to other people who come along and get a lot of benefits and are better at caring for people, maybe for a short term, but in the long term, how is it going to work out? Anyway, he says, the writer says that the protesters were also cheering speakers who voiced broader grievances, like against the political elite, the EU bureaucrats, and the mainstream media they blame for allowing multiculturalism to water down their national culture. So they're quite aware, these people, these protesters, these 10,000 protesters in Dresden last Monday, that there's a number of things that are behind all this one problem of allowing all these refugees and foreigners into their country. And they know who they are, and this is why the people in power are not going to, they're going to do everything they can not to allow it. They're not going to go along. They're not going to say, well, this is the people. See, the protesters are saying, we are the people. We are the people. And we should be listened to, but they're not going to listen to them because they're not going to accept any of these restrictions on themselves. Now let's see. And then the worst statement of all was a police union chairman in Dresden. You know, the authorities in Dresden are really terrible. You know how they don't want to allow the February march for commemorating the bombing of Dresden, that terrible bombing of Dresden. They hate that. They try to do everything in their power to stop it. And that's where he's from. And he says that he cited the challenge posed by the new mass rallies of people who he described as voicing this diffuse hostility, fear, and resentment against anything foreign to them. That's what they always do, isn't it? They word it in such a way as to make out that those who are standing up for them, their country and their nation and their culture are fearful. You know, that's been going on for the longest time by the liberals. They say that conservatives or right-wingers are so fearful. They're fearful of anything different. Oh, and they resent those who are different from them because they might be better. And they don't want to, you know, they can't face the fact that they're losers. Because then he goes on to say, these people out in the street protesting, many of them have failed in their lives and their jobs, and they project onto others their own failure and are looking for scapegoats. See, that's how they do it. And a lot of people, they hear that and they don't want to be connected with that. They want to portray these people as failures, who can't make it on themselves, and so they're looking for some scapegoat to blame their failure on, their lack of a job or whatever. and they're looking to excuse their own inadequacy. So then he says, we need to pay careful attention to them so they're not drawn in by the right-wing Pied Pipers. So we need to pay careful attention to these failures, he says, I guess that's what he's talking about, and who are looking for scapegoats so that they're not pulled in by the right wing. Boy, they hate the right wing, and they're not going to, I know they're going to go after these people. In fact, they're already doing it. What's this thing I've got here? It's an article talking about how Germany has become the number two recipient of immigrants, except for the United States. It surpassed all countries in Europe. I don't know how it surpassed the United Kingdom, but it says it has now surpassed every country except the United States to become the world's number two recipient of immigrants. And this was not always the case, you see, and it points out that when Helmut Kohl was Chancellor of Germany from 1982 to 1998, that long, 16 years, he declared that Germany was not an immigrant country. So at that time, you know, they had a different idea about Germany. And when they still had the Deutschmark and they were still very strong on their own, and before the European Union pulled everybody into it and everything started going downhill, you had this union of European nations, which all had to act the same and agree, and they were getting lots of money from countries like Germany, Britain too. And then now you have a dictatorial regime there from Brussels, and Germany has to go along with the program. In fact, Germany under Merkel is leading the program, and it would be doing so under anybody who got elected, unless they would decide in Germany, which is a possibility, to vote for the Alternative for Germany, which is not, or is it Alternative for Deutschland? It is not ideal, but because it isn't ideal, it's accepted as a party, and they're electable. So that would be the best bet right now, because they're unfriendly to the European Union, the Alternative for Germany. But, you know, it's hard for these German people, and it seems to be hard for people all over, everywhere, to vote for anything new. They end up voting for the old thing that they're familiar with, which is not going to take them to where they need to go. But they're hesitant. And like UKIP has been around for quite a while before it finally, people got used to this man, they got used to the party, they got used to seeing him and so on and listening, and finally they started being able to vote for him. You can't vote for something, it doesn't seem like people are willing to vote for something new, you know, in just a year or two. It was that Germany has become this immigration nation now. I didn't go over this this part like I should have, so I can't find what part of it I should be talking about. All right, because I'm going to go to, what I'm going to do now is take a little bit early. I'm going to play a little light music by Herman Prey, I really wanted to play this thing by Brahms. You know, I was going to play some Christmas music, and I had gotten some, but because of my messed up downloads, I couldn't even upload it. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to upload this program today. I think I'll be able to get hold of it some way, but I didn't have time to mess with it, so I don't have any. So I don't have any of it here. I'm very sorry about that. That's the way things have been going. So I think I will play though this Heinrich Schliemann. This is a beautiful song. It's a Brahms melody, and it's very relaxing and pleasant, so I think I'll play that, 3 minutes and 50 seconds, and after, then we'll be back just about on time to resume the program at the top of the hour.
Ja, du weißt es, teure Seele, von Richard Strauss, und Wer in die Fremde will wandern, von Hugo Wolf. mit Heinrich Schlussnuss. Unfreiwilliger Abgesang auf eine Welt, von der nur die Trümmer übrig blieben.
Okay, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So this is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday afternoon with Carolyn on December 13th, 2014, Saturday the 13th. I should really sum up a little bit what I talked about in that first hour, maybe a little bit too passionately or angrily, without too much proper terminology or better, a more quiet way that I should probably be using, but I get very excited when I think about this stuff. It just is so clearly crazy, and that's the point that I really wanted to bring out, that we are living in a system, in a world that is so obviously, so clearly bent on destroying our civilization and our cultures, and particularly white culture, it's so clearly being done, and yet with protestations that, oh no, it won't hurt you. No, this is necessary. This is modern life, and this is the way it has to be now. And you're only if you're afraid of this, it's because you're just you're afraid that you're not good enough to compete with all these people, and you're afraid of what's new and different, and you can't live with people who are different from yourself, and it's all painted as demeaning the people, demeaning us and our culture and our way of life, and our wish to live amongst our own people. And the same way, let me just say, it takes a lot of courage for the Europeans and for Germans in particular to go out there in those protests, because they've got all their agents infiltrated within there, and they know who's there, and they know how to punish people for what they're doing. So the people who are doing it, and there needs to be a lot more, as I said, are brave people. Even though it seems like they can just get lost in the crowd there, and to some extent most of them can, but you can suffer consequences from doing so. And here in the United States, we should be protesting against what these blacks are doing right now in their protests. We should be doing counter-protests. And nobody's organizing that, as far as I know. And there isn't, it's very difficult to get white Americans, I'll just stick with the Americans right now, to do anything in a group fashion. And it's not going to be the white nationalists are not going to do it. A while back, Kyle Hunt tried to the white man's march. Put some time and effort into it. It was not possible to do it. So they came up with some other ideas to do and try to make it, you know, get as much publicity from it as possible, but it really was, it only pointed out the weakness of whites in America rather than the strength when you've got more action coming from black people. And of course, as I said, the blacks are being, have to be financed by Jews and helped by Jewish media and helped by Jewish organizations in every kind of way. That's true. But if we can't stand up against that, then we're going to have our grand jury system change. We're going to have black cops all over the place. We're going to have black prosecutors. We're going to have black judges. We're going to have blacks running things to protect the blacks. And another thing to remember is that blacks are never satisfied. They're never satisfied. Just like Jews are never satisfied, but if they say, well, we need this, we're unhappy about this, and when they get that, then they're still unhappy because they still can't really improve their lot. They can't improve their life. They can't be what they're not. And even if everything was run by blacks in this country, the country would just go to hell, like Detroit. You know, the whole place would be like that, and they'd still be blaming white people for it. They would never blame themselves. Well, a little more on that as we go along, not about the blacks, but about the Jews. So I guess that's a good enough summing up, best I can do for now. And somebody brought to my attention, it was Don brought to my attention this morning, this new story on Winston Churchill in the Independent, in the United Kingdom Independent, that there is set to unveil a bust of Winston Churchill in Jerusalem this weekend. So again, today or tomorrow, or maybe they're doing it right now, by the Jewish supporters of Churchill in Israel. He's controversial there to some extent. He is some support him, and some think he's great and a big friend of the Jews, and others don't, or others are more critical of him. But the man who's a trustee of the Jerusalem Foundation, which has been behind this project to commemorate Churchill in Israel, says, as a passionate Zionist all his life and a Philo-Semite, Churchill has been under-recognized. Well, okay, let's see what else they say. He says, some more things about Churchill. But then they point out that this statue of Churchill, which is just a bust, just a few yards away from the King David Hotel. So, you know, and the King David Hotel is known to be where the Jewish, in fact, it was a false flag, took place where they bombed the terror bombing of that hotel and killed a lot of British people and British officers who were there in 1946 because they were unhappy with the British, the way the British were ruling under their mandate to rule Palestine. And, you know, the Jews, the Negroes have taken a lesson from the Jews, or they're being taught that you always want more. No matter what is being done for you, you push it further and push it further. So that's what they're all doing. So there's because of that British mandate, there's still a lot of antipathy toward the British rule at that time among the Jews. It's still very strong because they felt like the Britain didn't help them the way they should have. They started trying to be more fair-minded and think somewhat about the Arabs too. And the Jews really feel like the Arabs don't deserve any kind of attention or concern or at all. It all should go to them. Some say that, you know, they're unhappy that Churchill turned back Jewish immigrants trying to reach Palestine during the Second World War. But others say that he was one of the greatest supporters of the Zionist movement and that he should be acknowledged for his role in helping make the 1917 Balfour Declaration real. Most Israelis will remember Churchill for his role in defeating Hitler and as the man who set the world against the Nazis. So the biggest thing that Jews like about Churchill, or remember about Churchill, is that they say, you know, he played a big role in defeating Hitler, who is the one they hate the most, and he set the world against the Nazis, they say. Another person, though, says something a little different when I get to it. In any case, Israeli politician Isaac Herzog, says Churchill is not really commemorated here, and for lots of reasons he should be. He says that that Churchill's long alliance with the Jews during the early part of the 20th century is, his official biographer, Martin Gilbert, who himself was a Jew and has been one of the single biggest champions of Churchill, Gilbert pointed out how close Churchill felt to the Jews and how much he did for the Jews. But some others, there's a little bit of disagreement here, but I will go on with Eli Shaltiel, a senior fellow at the Israel Democracy Institute, who says that Churchill's attitude toward the Jews was complicated. The Jewish state was a way of solving the Jewish problem. Once they had a state of their own, it would serve their very uniqueness. They would be normal like any other nation. You know, it's interesting that Hitler also fell into the idea that if the Jews had a state of their own, that might solve the Jewish problem and they could all go there, and the world would be a better and more peaceful place. So it wasn't just Churchill that went along with that. A lot of people went along with that at the time. But Churchill's not blamed for it, but Hitler is, because he's supposed to have shown that he wasn't sincere in his antipathy towards the Jews, which of course he was. Here's an interesting sentence. The question of Auschwitz concentration camp, where thousands were killed daily, they just throw that in there into that article, also remains a bone of contention. Critics say he put Allied lives before Jewish ones by failing to bomb it in 1944. See, I think, you know, I read that, and I'm just like, can you believe that they fault Churchill for putting Allied lives before Jewish lives in not bombing the Auschwitz concentration camp? Well, they're saying that he should put Jewish lives before Allied lives. How is he going to put them both together? Obviously, they seem to be seeing it as a choice. But for Jews, and we'll see this in this book I'm going to be talking about, it's all about them. It's all about, nothing counts in the world for them except what's happening to Jews. Nothing. They just can't see anything else. So they say things like this without even thinking that it sounds straight to criticize Churchill when 1944 rolled around for putting Allied lives before Jewish ones. Well, it sounds like it was one or the other, right? It's just crazy. And then there's a Washington-based scholar writing a book about Churchill named Edward Luttbach, who is even more uncomplimentary toward him, and he claims that Churchill willfully ignored the plight of Hungarian Jews. You know, by 1944, certainly Churchill was not so sympathetic toward the Jews anymore, and Churchill and Roosevelt knew that there were no extermination camps. They knew that, but they allowed the rumors to continue, and after the war was over, they used them to deter blame away from themselves. But he had changed by then. He had woken up a little bit to what the Jews were like. Let's see, another complaint against Churchill from those who are not convinced that he was their friend is that Britain continued to rigorously enforce stiff immigration quotas to Palestine to appease the Arabs during a time of war. Well, there again, you know, they're accusing him of trying to consider the Arabs and what their needs and their desires as well as the Jews, but he wasn't supposed to do that. He was just supposed to cater to the Jews and forget the Arabs. And so that's a fault of Churchill's, according to them. And this Mr. Luttbach, who is writing this book, The American, he said, in 1944, Churchill, lifelong friend of the Jews, became Hitler's remaining Holocaust ally. You see, the thinking, the crazy, it shows these people are sick, sick, sick. This Luttbach is a Jew. Sick and insane in the way they look at things. Everything is, in 1944, after being friend of the Jews all these years, because he didn't do what we wanted him to do about Auschwitz or whatever, he became Hitler's remaining Holocaust ally. What a way to put it. Of course, Hitler is the greatest evil that ever was for Jews. And in the end, the British didn't like the Stern Gang because they were actually a terrorist group, and they found out that they were plotting to kill Churchill. The Stern Gang was going to kill Churchill, who was supposed to be their friend, as well as another politician, Ernest Bevin. But in the end, it was not Churchill who was killed, but his close friend, Lord Moyne, M-O-Y-N-E, who was assassinated by the Stern Gang in Cairo in November 1944. Boy, there's a lot that I've written some about the Stern Gang in relation to Poland and Elie Wiesel and so on. There's a lot that has never really been brought to light about all that. I mean, it's maybe brought to light, but it hasn't been made into popular knowledge. People don't know about it. So after this, after his close friend was killed by the Stern Gang, he was not so gung-ho about the Jews in Israel and the Jews in Palestine. And in an address to the House of Commons, he made it clear by saying, if our dreams, and I point out that he used the word our there, so he was joining himself with the Zionists in 1944. Himself, he was doing that. He says, if our dreams for Zionism are to end in the smoke of assassins' pistols and our labors for its future to produce only a new set of gangsters worthy of Nazi Germany, many like myself will have to reconsider the position we have maintained so consistently and so long in the past. I just point out the terrible hypocrisy of that, because in spite of what he's trying to compare the Stern Gang with the Nazis as being also gangsters who go around killing people, it was not the Nazis who went around assassinating people. It was the British who were the masters of political assassinations and who did plenty of them, including the one of Reinhard Heydrich and the Polish prime minister or foreign minister and any number of other people that they decide to take care of in that way. Boy, you know, it's just, it makes you sick. So I'm going to move on now to this book that I talked about a little bit on an earlier program, the one titled We Won't See Auschwitz by this French Jew, Jeremy Dress, in telling in a cartoon comic book style form the story of his trip to Poland with his brother and their adventures there. They didn't think they didn't go there to see the concentration camps, and after they were there, they didn't choose to go there. They went to a few cities and they were looking really for places where their grandmother had lived and her parents were buried, that she had told them about, and so on and so forth. So this is a real story by a real French Jew about their real adventure, and it's it has some lessons, I thought, for me, and I think the main theme is the loss of the Jewish community in Poland. That's what it was all focused on, that as they went to Poland and talked to Jews, pretty much only Jews, most Polish people only spoke Polish, and they didn't speak Polish. They spoke French and English. Well, he spoke English. I suppose the other one did, too. And they could speak to Jews there who spoke English. Maybe they spoke some Yiddish. I don't know if they knew some Yiddish. They might have. But in any case, so there was a kind of a language barrier, but they didn't speak to any Poles, except a couple of in official position that they had to communicate with. And they were afraid to do that. They didn't want to. And anyway, their idea was that the Jewish community in Poland had been 3 million strong, was the greatest Jewish community in the world, I guess. And this loss of it due to the Nazis and World War II was a tragedy beyond belief, you know, it's a tragedy. And they wanted, and who's to blame? You know, who do they blame? Well, in this book, of course, first they blame the Nazis, and they always call them Nazis. They seldom use the word Hitler. I don't know, I might have seen it a couple times, but they use the word Nazis all the time. And, or I should say he does, because this one fellow wrote it. But other people are talking. And he says that he took a recorder with him, and when they talked with people, he recorded it so that he could give the story back, or in any case in the book he did. He was able to say what these people said pretty much exactly, and you can tell that. You can tell that they're real people and they are really saying these things. I mean, that's the impression you get. So he recorded all that and then put it in his story. And they blamed the Nazis, and then they blamed the Polish Catholics shows their churches always with the crosses, or when they went to the cemeteries, they'd be first going past gravestones with crosses on them, and they knew that didn't have anything to do with them. They'd go right on. They were looking for the menorahs and so on, and then they'd finally come to their own Jewish graves. And they also showed statues of Our Lady at some of the Catholic churches, but these things were viewed, even in the story, as kind of like alien and dangerous places that they avoided altogether. Christian churches, and which were mostly Catholic there, and crosses and so on. And in this book, every Jew is portrayed only, and I mean only, as good in the nice. You start liking them because they're portrayed so well as good, harmless, well-educated, or at least well-accomplished and intelligent, as sensitive, as innocent, and they're all aware that they're victims. They're all aware that as a Jew, and in some cases as a Polish Jew, or a Jew whose ancestors were in Poland, they're victims. They're victims, and they were victimized by this whole situation. And this is something that has kind of a trauma in their lives, and it's kind of broken the connection to their past and their ancestors, and they need a lot of healing. And what was brought out in the story is that there's a lot of Polish people and people with Polish ancestry who are discovering their Jewish roots and are going to Poland to look into it. And there's some organizations there that help them, and he talked to these people in these organizations and found out about it. And they didn't know any of this when they started. He went with his brother. He went first, and his brother Martin met him there. He is Jeremy. So Jeremy and Martin, he was able in here to really get the people, the personality of the various people, and his personality too, and his brother's personality. At least everybody has a personality. And I have to say he's a clever person, like so many Jews are so clever. And he can do a good job of what he does. And he did a good job with this. And everybody comes across as a convincingly real person. But as I said, there are no bad Jews in here. There are bad Poles and bad Nazis and bad Goys, and they call him Goys. He uses the word Goy fairly often. And he uses the word community. And they all use the word community. All these Jews there, they use the word community to refer to what would be self-aware Jews living and associating together in any town or city in Poland today, because they're supposed to be such a minority, and they're not very well accepted, so then they don't feel like they're totally welcome. But they're there, and some of them have always been there, and some of them are coming newly coming there. Not necessarily to stay, but they call it a community, these groups they have, and they form their own community, which does not include any non-Jews. Never. They live amongst all these Goys, but they have these associations, and they get together with themselves and form these, and what they call their community is all Jewish. And the focus of the community is their Jewishness, their Jewish traditions, and things like that, their history. And they see Jews as always an alien presence among Goys, who are basically all anti-Semitic. They imagine all Goys to be anti-Semitic. They seem to, particularly in Poland, and they expect it, even if they don't know. They expect to be walking around among anti-Semites, and they're uncomfortable a little bit because of it. And they believe that all the Poles are anti-Semitic. And they even show a fear of having to be in their presence alone a lot. There's a general it would be more like a distrust of Goys in general. They're not. You can't trust Jews. Can't trust them. That they might. What do I put here? They might just go and turn into. They see Goyim as unpredictable, like we see the Negroes. Well, like we see the Blacks as in the United States, and the way they're behaving now, we see them as you never know when they're going to do something violent. And that's the way these Jews see the Goys and see the Poles, as just as unpredictable and savage. They imagine pogroms taking place. The pogroms are very real to them. And so when Jeremy and Martin went to Zelichow, where they wanted to find out, because their grandmother's family was from there, when they got out of Warsaw and went there, they were very nervous and frightened. And they didn't even know if they were going to be able to drive in there and walk around. They came up with some story about how they could tell people that they weren't Jews. They were looking for Jewish things, but they weren't Jews. They were doing it for a friend of theirs who couldn't come, who couldn't come himself. So sent them to come and look it up. And they were really took this kind of thing seriously. So And they really believe also, and this comes throughout the whole thing, that they are the most enlightened ones in the world. You know, they're the most enlightened beings. And for that reason, they suffer from the Goy, who are kind of an ignorant rabble in large part, even though a lot of them are not. But, you know, it's clear. They don't say it, but it's clear from the way everybody's talking. Not so much this author, but all the people he talks to, that every Jew is an enlightened being, and they're superior to the Goys. And, of course, they believe 100% without a doubt in the Holocaust. And they bring it up now and then, but they often don't like to talk about it, and they call it when the tragedy took place or whatever. So I'm going to go through a few pages here to give you a feeling of some of these things I've been saying. He gets there and he goes to this one organization. Some pages. Oh, here it is. A couple of Jewish men are there, and they've got something called, whatever it's called, one of these groups for Jews in Poland, in Warsaw. And he's asked, do you know how many Jews were left after the war? And this one man says 300,000 out of 3.5 million. So they've got that down. There you go with that, with the Jews, 10%. You know, they always go, the truth is usually 10% of what they say. And here he's saying, doing it the other way around. They say there are 3.5 million and only 300,000 survived. And he said that between 40,000 and 50,000 were on the Nazi side, and 250,000 were on the Soviet side. So there's quite a lot more on the Soviet side. He said few survived on the Nazi side, many more under Soviet occupation, saying how the Russians treated their people very poorly, but if you compare the two, they were better off with the Russians, although they're in the gulags. But they hated the Russians. They hated the communists, too. They talk about that a lot also, how much they suffered under the communists. And in telling them about that, he says, Murnau was a Jewish neighborhood. Now, they're just talking about a Jewish neighborhood in Warsaw, and they act like it's practically the whole world. He says, Murnau was a Jewish neighborhood before the Nazis made it a ghetto for all the Jews from the city and surrounding area. It was completely destroyed after the uprising in 1943. Today, more than 50,000 apartments have been built without a care in the world for remembering. They just built new stuff over the old ghetto and neighborhood, and says that the Jewish quarter is underneath the ground now. If they dug down there 100 years from now, they'd find the old Jewish quarter. So they think that everything about them should be preserved. And, they think of Poland as their country more than they can do that in some other countries, because they were there for a long time, and they considered themselves to be their native land, although it wasn't. But, you know, they consider it that way, their homeland, in a sense, one of the Jewish homelands there in Poland, because there are so many of them. I'll move on. We don't get stuck. I'm probably making a lot of noise with this book. Okay, now then they, when his brother came, they went to the Jewish ghetto, which is preserved, you know, and they have it all fixed up and sort of a tourist attraction. And what they did there, they found some things like a woman telling them about it and saying that the buildings that now the buildings there belong to the city and to the Shalom Foundation. Someone launched a project there called the I Can Still See Their Faces, and they put huge posters of these Jews who supposedly died in the Holocaust on this one of the big buildings there, a number of the big buildings, big blow-ups of family photos that they collected from survivors of their relatives. Yeah, and then they go to the famous synagogue called the, I don't know how to pronounce it, Neue Street Synagogue, something like that, and they say that it's the only synagogue that survived the catastrophe, still operating in Poland. See, that's what they use the word catastrophe for what happened to them. It's from the beginning of the 20th century. They go inside, and this person who's showing them around a little bit says, when the war began, the Nazis trashed this place and used it as a stable. How terrible. It was still standing after the bombing in 1945. It was in terrible shape, of course. So for them, the bombing of 1945 was a terrible thing. But all the bombings that took place in Germany and all the bombings that other people endured, they don't even talk about it. They don't even think about it. I realize that they're in Poland to learn about their Jewish history, but it just strikes me that this is all they ever think is important. And somebody afterwards, they were in a synagogue, were they in the same synagogue? They said after the war, the city council and the community fought over ownership of the synagogue. In the end, the court delivered its verdict. And today, the synagogue belongs to the community. The mayor's office helped a lot with the reconstruction. Well, that's the way the conversations go. Now, I'm going through quite a few pages to get to another spot. It's not easy to do this. All right, okay. Then they go to see several people who run rabbis and people who run different little organizations. And this rabbi is telling them a story, and he said that one day he was up in the Tatra Mountains just doing some hiking, and night was falling, and he was walking peacefully along. He passed two young people that he noticed, and he heard the words Brudny Zid, which means dirty Jew, and he thought, okay, I've been in this army, I'll fight like a Samson. And he was going to turn back to confront these two young guys. And he said, actually, they were just messing around with each other. They hadn't seen me. I left. So what he's saying is these young guys were just joking with one another, but I don't think they said dirty Jew. I think he thought he heard that because he's so paranoid. This is just an example of how they feel as soon as they find themselves in the company of non-Jews. They think that they're going to be hurt by these people. They think these people hate them and they're going to attack them or what have you. And they imagine things. So he said, it was just my imagination. When you're a Jew, sometimes you imagine things. At least he admitted it. He's smiling about that. Quite a bit further on, he is, here's this page with the little airplane I wanted to bring up. He goes to visit this woman named Anna, who helps people discover if there's any documents. They call it the registries and so on in Poland that show that if they are from there, if their ancestors were, they have any birth certificates or documents showing, proving that they're Jewish. And a lot of them want to be Jewish. And this Anna says that she deals with all kinds of people who are trying to find out answers to the past that they've lost track of because people left and didn't take anything with them. And she says, she's talking about this bombed out cities like Warsaw. Sometimes it's very hard to find any registers there. And some of them were saved only by the zeal of town councilors. And they say the rabbi, a little shekel, fled his village as it went up in flames with the civil registers and a whole bunch of stuff from the synagogue. He fled across Russia all the way to the States. She says, but I don't buy it. No, I don't either. But that's the story because they why they're lost. And they have this little, in his drawing here, he's got a picture of a big book, you know, and one of them opened, which would be the registers of the people's birth and death and so on. And a bunch of, looks like smoke around them and in the top of a synagogue. And there's a plane flying in the air causing all this destruction. And guess this little plane has a swastika on the tail. And it has two German crosses, one on the fuselage, one on the under the wing. It's just a little cartoon drawing, but I want you to know that that's a Nazi plane that caused the loss of their ancestral records and so on, and why they can't find out information about themselves the way they'd like to. And then, now here he's... he's at a place and they meet, they're having a like a symposium. There's a bunch of well-known people here. It's a festival, Jewish festival in Krakow. It's the biggest Jewish festival in the world now, and lots of people come to it, which shows just how far Poland has come in allowing Jews to be recognized again, because they believe that during the communist years, they were really treated very, very badly, and the Poles were totally anti-Semitic, and they weren't welcome at all. And now they're saying that head of this festival director says, as a goy and the director of one of the biggest festivals of Jewish culture in the world, I've had a hard time finding my place. Most Catholics think I'm a Jew, and most Jews think I'm a Meshuga, which is Yiddish for madman. Well, he's trying to make a joke. But they said about this festival in Krakow that it's too much run by non-Jews and Americans, and they think it's a tourist thing, too, a kind of a publicity thing. It's not really something for Jews, and a lot of the Jews they talked to were criticizing it. But they've got some, like the executive director of the Taube Foundation for Jewish Life and Culture. She gives a talk, and she says, thanks to their courage, the generation of post-war Jews resisted the anti-Semitic measures of communist regimes. Thanks to them, our heritage has been saved. And then there's this Jan Spiewak, who's a representative from an organization called Zoom, who they spent some time talking to earlier, and he says that they got their religious education from a rabbi who was actually from the United States, and in summer camps with Jewish kids from the neighborhood. So he was giving thanks for that. And then there's Anna Makowka, who they've already talked to, too, who's a director of a group called that's an association of young Krakow Jews. She discovered she was Jewish when she was 18. Her parents were Jews who had who were highly educated and had assimilated and hid out during the war and didn't ever admit their Jewishness and didn't act like Jews and didn't practice it. And she didn't know until she was 18. And when she did learn it, it changed her life, and she ended up in this youth association and became its president. And she met her husband, who's, I suppose, also a Jew. And she's now happy in her Jewishness and helping to bring more Jews. And a couple more of these people, there's this man named Reisner, who's from the Genealogical Learning Center. He says, every day someone comes in with a new story. Quote, I just found out I was Jewish, that I had Jewish roots. I was cleaning my room and I found this photo proving I'm Jewish. Or my mother declared on her deathbed that she was Jewish. And he says, one day someone asked me, now that I'm Jewish, what should I do? And he just says, what an interesting question. Well, that's all that's in the story here about him. And then finally, Helise Lieberman, who's director of the Louder Warasha Jewish School in Warsaw. Her comment is, a new generation is making headway, raised with freedom, with its Jewish tradition. It bears all our hopes for the future. I'm happy to have helped it spread its wings. No, and then finally, Stanislaw Krajewski is director of the Polish Council for Jewish Christian Relations. He's got a kippah on. He's Jewish. He says, 20 years ago, who would have thought Jewish life would flower in Poland again and be facing classic questions of identity, transmission, disputes between religious movements that exist in the U.S. and everywhere else? So all of this was some kind of a celebration of Jews returning to Poland, of Jewish life returning to Poland, how wonderful it all is and how thrilled they all are. And it just reinforces that for Jews, they're not going to assimilate into non-Jewish culture. Although there are some who already have, I guess, like this one woman's parents had done so. But they want to continue to exist as Jews, as their Jewish community, wherever they happen to want to be. And they travel. So if things are, if they're not Israeli Jews, and even Israeli Jews are willing to go anywhere else at the drop of a hat, they don't feel like they have to be in Israel. They really don't. So it's like these are people who go where it works for them. And when it doesn't work for them anymore, they leave. Now, there were not 2,700,000 Jews murdered during the so-called World War II and Holocaust. That just didn't happen at all. So they went somewhere else, you know. They traveled somewhere else and then say, they're all killed. But when things get better somewhere, they might go back. And they want to be able to go wherever they feel like. And this is the question. One of the questions is, why should these people be able to create community in countries that they're only sort of native to, that they make out that they've been there a long time ago or something. Even in every country, they say, well, Jews have been here since such and such, since the beginning. You know, there have been some Jews, so that makes it a place that they feel like they have a right to be. But they feel like they have a right to be anywhere they want to go and to form their own community there, apart from the other, and to feel very different. All of these Jews, although they say it's because of the history of Poland, but they all were very, and I didn't read all this, all the times when they talked about anti-Semitism, but I missed some of those, but they say, well, they're very anti-Semitic, or they were all anti-Semites. They bring that up a lot. They believe that all the non-Jews are anti-Semites and that they can't trust any of them, but they're not going to provoke them because they want peace for themselves, they want safety and security for themselves, and they want to live amongst these, well, they want to live on these people's territory, in these people's economies, without flourish there as much as they can. This is what comes up, you know, in reading this. It's all kind of strange. Now, here's a guy named, how much time I got? Here's a fellow named Jean-Yves Potel that they met at this Krakow event. He's saying to Martin, most people say 20,000 Jews in Poland, 2,000 to 3,000 practicing Jews, 7,000 to 8,000 in associations. You know, about half of them are affiliated, and the other half are just still pretending to be Poles, maybe, or just not not wanting to come out as Jews or not wanting to be Jews maybe anymore. And Martin says, and those are the ones who came back? And this Potel says, yes, that's the big difference from Germany. 250,000 Jews came back from the Soviet Union where they had been deported, only 250,000. We estimate 40,000 Jewish survivors hid in Poland. They coped with anti-Semitic tensions. Incredible, says Martin. And Jean-Yves says, sure, but don't look at it that way. The end of the war was an extremely violent time, almost a civil war situation. And then he wants to leave, and they start walking. He says, the war ended with the Soviets taking over, forcing on Poland a regime the people didn't want. Jews who came from Russia were seen as communist spies. Now, they never bring out in any way whatsoever that Jews had anything to do with the Soviet Union or the kind of behavior of the Soviets when they took over Poland and the other countries. They never referred to anything like that. Jews are always victims of everybody. So they were victims of the Nazis, and they were victims of the Poles, and they were victims of the Soviets. And wherever they go, they're victims. But they manage, because they're such wonderful people, they manage to survive all the catastrophes. Then he comes upon, there's this page where this Potel, same guy, is talking away to them, explaining things to them, and says, they, meaning the Poles, made it a political ideology both to conduct anti-Zionist campaigns, and then they were saying, there is a fifth column in our country, and to advance such ideas as, and he has them saying, those ungrateful Jews, we helped them so much during the war. So he's putting down or pointing out that the Poles were anti-Zionist, but also a brag that they helped the Jews during the war, and they're calling the Jews ungrateful. They did help the Jews a lot. There was a lot of help. See, the Jews can't even accept that. These Jews cannot accept that the Poles, any Poles, ever helped them. Nobody ever helped them, according to them. Everybody treated them badly. And he says this provoked the events of March 68 and the departure of 20,000 people. Only a few Jews remained, you know, after the early 70s was the darkest time, he said. And Jews were leaving, the ones that were left. I want to point out, too, that, well, I probably already have, but I'll point it out again. Okay, well, it's just actually that the Jews left, but a few of them are assimilated, and they're not even thought of as Jews anymore. But he says, going on along the same line, he says, since there had been no collaborationist state, the regime created a vision of the Polish as innocent victims. We are blameless, in quotes. We are blameless, in quotes. There you go. You see, here's the wise man who's talking to these two travelers. Oh, I know what I was going to say. These two guys, and particularly the author, they're not practicing Jews, let alone Orthodox. They don't even, in France, where they've been living for a while because they were born there, even though their grandmother told them all about their family and so on, they don't really relate that much to anything Jewish, even like in not eating pork, because that came up once. But they're now here learning. You see, they're talking to all these people. They came to learn things, and so they're listening to everyone. And this man is making this what we know is the claim that they make, that they are now against the Poles totally, that the Poles have been trying to say that they never collaborated with anyone and that they are victims. And they created an idea, or he says a vision, of the Polish as innocent victims. We are blameless. And that is true of the Poles. They are doing that, and they have done that. And that's the same as, who else did that? Who else has been doing that? Well, I can't think of who I had in mind, but that's a common thing, you know, that nobody did anything bad to Jews except the Nazis, except the Germans. They're the bad ones. But the Jews aren't buying it. See, the Jews believe that the Poles were very bad to them. They blame the Poles for all kinds of things. They don't trust the Poles. They want to live there. They consider Poland to be a Jewish homeland, and they think Jews should come back there. But they don't feel friendly toward the Poles, and they want to blame the Poles because the Jews want to blame everybody. I know what I was going to say. This author and his brother are a little bit. They didn't know a lot of this stuff, and they're not practicing Jews, but they're quite open to all this, and they still believe all the things. Believe in the Holocaust. Believe in the persecution of the Jews and so on. All of that. And so there's nobody at all in this book who questions ever any of this. Never questions, says, well, I wonder if the Jews did something wrong. You know, this has been brought up so many times. How do Jews how do they explain why Jews have been disliked, why there's so much anti-Semitism, and nobody ever questions why? And they don't in this book. You'd think that it might come up in this book because they're kind of liberal-minded French Jews, but no, it doesn't. It's never mentioned. And then this fellow, the hotel fellow, says, and that's what's been questioned in intellectual debates ever over these last 20 years. That's why I called my book The End of Innocence. So this man has written a book called The End of Innocence, and what he means by that, the end of innocence for the Poles, the end of innocence for boys, for Gentiles. Nobody's innocent, except the Jews, of course. And I found that quite funny of note. And then the Jeremy says, are you of Polish descent? And he looks at him, he says, I'm neither Jewish nor Polish. I'm from Brittany. And they're like surprised at that. And he says he's been studying Poland for a long time, and his field was Central Europe and some kind of solidarity something. And anyway, he's all into being a part of this revival and in Poland and running this thing in Krakow. Okay, now the last few things I'm going to say here, because there's a lot that's really interesting, but he gets together back in Paris. He goes and meets this woman, Anna, who's been recommended to him, who is the daughter. This is the one who was the daughter of the two assimilated Jews who denied being Jewish and, you know, made themselves into Poles and Christians. And then at 18, they told her the truth, and she went off to join the Jews. And they're talking to her, and she's talking about her parents. And how she says that farmers hid her parents, that her parents went off into the rural area when the bad times came, and farmers hid them. And she says whether from the goodness of their hearts or for money, I don't know. They never told me. You see how they talk? Farmers hid them, but maybe it was for money. You know, maybe it wasn't because of the goodness of their hearts. And what would hiding them have to do with the goodness of their hearts anyway? Maybe they shouldn't have hid them because that was treasonous to their own what was going on. But they just assume that they should be taken care of by the goys. But they don't trust that they're not sure that the goys don't just do it for ulterior motives and not because they have good hearts. And then her mother was a biochemist, so she was some kind of physician. And she makes the point that her mother saved the life of a partisan of the Polish resistance. So it's because she saved the life of a Pole that made it pay back these farmers for hiding them and looking after them all those years. Well, they're just extremely partisan, these people. Then she says to him, talking about how she would never go back to Poland. She never wants to go back there. She left when she was young. And she says it's completely she says Jews here get all wide-eyed. For them, there are no more Jews in Poland. It's just a massive cemetery. But not for me. They're still just as anti-Semitic. So she doesn't have any sympathy for the Poles. For her, the Poles are anti-Semites. She's a Jew, and she has no intention of thinking that they could ever get along. And she calls these Jews that do wide-eyed. And she also says that everything in Poland that they saw was just a Disneyland financed by the Americans to enlighten the little Poles about the Jews who lived among them. They don't know anymore. For them, Jew is a pejorative word used as an insult. Where she finds all this, or they're convinced Jews look like the figurines in their souvenir shops. But she's very cynical about it all. But she tells him not to be and to come to his own conclusions. Well, the next thing is that he mentions that the graveyards in, he goes to a cemetery in Paris, and he's looking for the Jewish part of it, like he looked for Jewish graves in Poland, and he finds them. And he's talking about them, and he finds one person from Zelichow, which they visited. And then he says, it's so well kept. It's a change from the graveyards in Warsaw and Zelichow. You know, all the Jewish graveyards there are all tall grass and weeds. They're very totally unkempt. And they kind of act like it's because they don't care about the Jewish cemeteries, the country. Why don't the Jews go over there and clean up the cemeteries? There's plenty of Jews there, but I think it's a Polish way. I bet Polish cemeteries are not very well kept either. So I'm going to close here with the fact that there's an article, very short little thing by his brother Martin, who wrote a little afterword for the book. And some of the things he said was talking mostly about their grandmother, Temma, they called her Temma. He said she could never stop talking to us. She knew how to recreate the fear she experienced in occupied Paris, a Paris where she survived by hiding in a closet, even as her ears, accustomed to Yiddish from her childhood, were flooded with the orders of Nazi soldiers. And she was a young adult when she went there to Paris with her mother and sisters, but she said she survived. They said she survived by hiding in a closet. I guess I don't know whose closet, but when they were maybe looking for Jews to round up. But this is the idea they have all the time. It's all the only way they can think about the Nazis, and they had the impudence to succeed. They said that the Jews, that her apartment remained intact in Paris, well, why wouldn't it have, had the impudence to succeed where the Nazis had failed. Just had to make another dig at the Nazis there, about their how they lost. And then when he talked about Zelichow, Zelichow, he said that they found this Jewish cemetery by looking at a bronze plaque at the Market Square. There was nothing about Jews in the town. But they happened to see this bronze plaque at the Market Square with the inscription Zadowski Cemeteries, which meant Jewish cemetery. Zadowski means Jewish, he says. That's how they found it there. And he makes the comment here that quietly, without making a fuss, the children of Poland were returning to their past, bumping up against it, rediscovering bits of often overshadowed personal history. And he and his brother did the same. And you know, he calls them the children of Poland, meaning, of course, Jews. So everything, as I said, everything is about the Jews. Everything that they care about is Jews. And from people who are not fanatical Jews, not even practicing Jews, it leaves one with the sense that they will never, ever reconcile. Jews will never, ever reconcile themselves to the true World War II history or to the National Socialists, to the Holocaust. Never. They're totally incapable of it. Their whole worldview, their whole life view is made up of what happened to the Jews at that time and how the Jews are coming back from it, and how the Jews have to be always wary of the Goy, and how the Jews are superior to the Goy, and all of those things. So it leaves you with this idea that if we don't do something, if we don't face up to the Jewish question, oh, somebody's calling me here. I wonder how long this person has been on the line. If we don't face up to the Jewish question, we will never deal with Holocaust or with history at all. We'll never be able to do it. And how many people are willing to deal with the Jewish question? As I mentioned some of that on Monday, that they're not. Most people are not. This idea that we will all get together doesn't seem to be logical, considering what we see actually happening. Well, hi, caller. You sounded kind of like Don. Yeah? Hello?
Well,
Hattie.
Yeah.
Hi, Hattie. Yeah, well, let's just continue on. Go ahead. What did you have to say?
Well, I was thinking when you were talking about the Jews' opinion of the Goys, meaning the Poles, that actually you would get a lot of non-Jews saying similar things about the Poles. For example, there's a Donald Day, who was a Chicago Tribune reporter, wrote a book called Onward Christian Soldiers, where he made comments on various countries in Europe, and he made very unflattering comments to the Poles about, you know, how primitive they were. But he made a distinction between different kinds of Poles. He thought that there was a higher type of Pole with square head, like Pilsudski, and then there were the round-headed Poles who were just at a rather low level, you know. So, you know, you can... I would be surprised to read Jews making those kinds of comments about the Germans if there were some living among the Germans that kept a diary.
Oh, you would? You think that they wouldn't think the Germans were anti-Semitic?
I think. Well, they might think they were anti-Semitic, sure, but they wouldn't have quite the same opinion as what you conveyed about the Poles.
Yeah, well, that could very likely be true. And they certainly don't have that opinion about the Americans, who they seem to like. They seem to think the Americans are pretty good people. The Americans are always helping them. But the kind of the point is that the Jews don't see anybody as really friendly to them. You know, they don't give anybody credit for doing anything for them. It's all their own doing.
True.
It really comes through in this book, even though I don't think it was intended to. You know, it's not written by a person who hates non-Jews or anything like that. It's somebody who works with them and fits in to society, and yet the whole thing is just how they're so conscious of their Jewishness. Now, these two probably weren't quite so conscious of it as they were on this trip. But the people that they came in contact with certainly were. And you're right, though. There's a lot of people have criticism about the Poles. I'm one. But I left that out. I wasn't trying to attack the Poles today, but just to point out what this book revealed.
I think Poland was a place where the Jews could find an easy niche, you know. As you know, they sort of interposed themselves as a bourgeoisie between the Polish peasants and the Polish nobility.
Right, and so then the Poles rightfully did resent them, but even though they resented them, they're today they don't like them either. But they're afraid to come out with it, because everybody is so afraid of being an anti-Semite, and this is the problem. Don't you think, Hattie, that if we don't deal with this Jewish question properly, we're afraid if we think that we can tolerate Jews in our society? Well, what's your position on that? Maybe you have a different position than I do.
Whether we can tolerate Jews?
Yeah.
I think that given the direction that events have taken, we definitely have to take the power of media away from Jewish hands. That's a minimum.
Well, that's right. There you go. Wouldn't that be something if we could take the media away from Jewish hands? But you know, the way it looks, I don't like to be all completely negative, but I don't see any of this happening. You know, I don't see any group. I'd like to bring up just for a minute that it took someone like Adolf Hitler and the people he gathered around him and the conditions that were present at the time for Germans in Germany and all of that, a time before the Jews were as powerful as they are today, although they were pretty powerful, as it turned out. But I don't see anything like that happening. And amongst whites who are aware of Jew-wise and so on, they're just there's just a bunch of disparate people who don't get along, and there's no strong center of it. Now, a big test can be with this anti-Islam thing in Europe, whether they can hold together, these people, or whether the forces of the power blocks in the countries will be able to destroy their movement and discourage them. And the same thing with what's going on with the blacks in the United States today, with this new movement toward reining in the police and reining in the justice system and so on, reining in local government in determining and how they operate. Whites need to stand up to that. We need to stand up to that, but there's no way to, except for people talking about it, there's no movement taking place against it. Comment on that.
That's true. People right now are all riled up about blacks.
Well, and rightly so, because they're going to be used to make a lot of changes. Can you imagine the police chief in most places in this country being a black person? Is that right? You know, would that be allowed? I could see that happening.
People get all worked up over the obvious things, and they don't really look at the history and the causes of how things develop. All of this trouble with blacks right now is because of decades of Jewish propaganda. Propaganda that came from Jews. I mean, we know about this. You can listen to E. Michael Jones talk about it, about how the Jews started their vendetta against the white South after the Leo Frank trial. And they've never stopped that propaganda, getting the blacks riled up against the white people. The core of that problem, the Jews, the Jewish propaganda. They've got that propaganda that they've been pushing all this time for 100 years now. That's the reason for this. And at the same time that this is going on, all this disturbance in Ferguson and so forth, which is it's a huge distraction from what? Immigration amnesty, right? Or mm-hmm. illegal immigrant mm-hmm. amnesty, right? And who pushed right. that? Well, it was Charles Krauthammer. Charles Krauthammer was the one at the time of the 2012 election who suggested that the Republicans need to get on with immigration amnesty. And I'm sure whoever told Obama was probably a Jew also, but it was certainly on the Republican side, it was Charles Krauthammer.
So well, that's all
there's
true.
Not even any. There's not even any resistance on the Republican side because they worship Charles Krauthammer, the Jew.
Well, they worship Israel. More and more, they just out and out worship Israel, the Republicans, the whole Republican Party. So it's hopeless. But, you know, what you say is absolutely true. But it's too subtle and sophisticated for the masses of people or, you know, the average person to be willing to say that. So they see what's going on in front of their eyes, what the blacks are doing. They know it's bad news. For not only for white people, but for the country to be a sensible. It's insane to have black people in charge of things like that. We see what they do, you know. So that's where really you have to get the outrage going about what's happening, because you can't point and say, well, behind these all these blacks or these Jews and Charles Krauthammer, that's not going to work. Well, you can point to when you brought up the Jewish control of the media. They know the media is unfair, so you can point to that. That's for sure. But as soon as you bring up Jew and Jewish, people run the other way. They run away from that. They don't want to be associated with that. Go ahead.
That's more true with right-wingers than Republicans, though. I think there are a lot of people on the left that are willing to talk about Jews now.
Well, they are because of Palestine, Israel. But as far as anything else, they don't, and it doesn't help the right wing movement to start turning things over to the left, because they're never going to come up with the right answer.
Yeah. So there's got to be some kind of a synthesis.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I guess there does. It doesn't appeal to me. I'd like to see just the right take over and do the right thing, but I know that's unrealistic. So it's other people that need to come up with solutions, but I don't see people really working seriously at a real solution. Everybody's just given their criticism and saying the things that we know are true, but they're not in a way that's do you think that someone like David Duke with his message reaches any kind of mass group of white Americans? I mean, I don't think so. I don't think he's doing that. But do you think he is?
I have no idea what his audience is. I suspect he reaches some people.
What would it take? He's not going to do it. What would it take for somebody to come along and start organizing things? I think there should be a white American's reaction to what the blacks are doing with these protests because of the grand juries and the police.
I'm not really into reacting to the blacks. To me, that's a big diversion. What I would rather see is efforts to get the black right page. I mean, that may sound hopeless, but nobody has really tried. You know, I mean, I wrote a little bit about that A Party of Plutocrats Has No Future, right, for Occidental mm-hmm. Observer a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I wrote it about getting the blacks on board with doing something about immigration, because about half of them already understand that this is very bad for them. You know, the immigration is very bad for them. All that has to be done, if the Republicans wanted, or if right-wingers, conservatives wanted to get blacks on their side, all they have to do is be overtly anti-immigration and make the blacks think about that, right? Say, you know, Mexicans are coming here to take your job, vote Republican, right? That's all they have to do. But they don't do that. Instead, they do stupid symbolic stuff, have some immigrant from Africa on the stage at their party convention, which does not impress the average black at all.
They're on the side of the Jews. They're on the side of the Jews. They're not going to upset the Jews. Republicans are lovers of Jews, so they're not going to do that. Who's going to do it? It's got to be somebody from outside of this party system.
Yeah, well, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. All I can see to do is just to make intelligent criticisms of what's going on and try to straighten things out incrementally. You know, I don't see anything else to do, but it seems like an obligation to do that.
Well, at least these protests in Germany, which might spread, although, I don't know why it happened in Dresden. I guess East Germany's always been a better place for things like that than West Germany is. So I don't, but I know they're going to be trying to stop it. I know they're going to be doing everything in their power to to bring this to an end. They're not going to allow things like this. They're not going to allow saying that we don't want this and we don't want that from the people. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see what they do. They're going to stop it. And we're just stuck, you know, unless we quit voting for these people. Why do they vote? Well, I brought that up a little bit, but, you know, they must realize that, but there's not enough of them. But it seems like even the ones who are out there protesting now, a whole lot of them will end up voting for what? Angela Merkel or something. Again, well, they just had an election there, but they're saying in their local elections, whatever. They're voting for the same damn people.
Alternative für Deutschland made a very good showing in their first election, you know. So
that's who they should vote for.
It's a very rapidly. My Bavarian friend was very enthused about how well they showed in their first election, and you know they did that without taking votes away from the NPD, right? So they didn't take votes from the NPD. They took from the mainstream parties. So it's all plus, right?
Yeah.
It's all positive. And, you know, it's not like the U.S. system where you have to get a majority or it doesn't mean anything. They have proportional representation over there. If you get 5% of the vote, you are somebody, right?
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, you get some representation. Well, people should stop criticizing Alternative for Deutschland because they're not perfect, because they are electable, and that's who people should be voting for, and see how high they can get.
You get over here in the USA, people want everything to be super simple, right? It has to be all or nothing. They can't. A lot of people here, especially in our white nationalist milieu, they have a hard time grasping that somebody is doing some good in a certain situation. It's either, he's got to say that we need to gas all the Jews, or he's not doing any good. Right? That's the way a lot of people seem to think. Ridiculous.
No, I know. It's just stupid. It's stupid here. And you can see that there's more going on in Europe, and they're willing to do things, than there is in this country. There's nothing going on in this country, except, you know, amongst people who are pay attention to things like the alternative movement, but most people don't even know it exists, except as something to be wary of. But still,
I don't know if I'd say that nothing's going on here. It's just harder to tell because of the way our political system is set up. If there's anything going on, it's not on the surface.
But if it's not on the surface at all, then it's not making any impact. Just because people are, maybe there's people organizing stuff. Oh, sure, I'm sure there are. There's people doing things, and they're hoping, you know, that they'll be able to, if certain things happen in the future, they'll be prepared, or if there's some riots or something. I don't know what kind of plans they might have, but I don't see evidence of it, anything. I just don't have the feeling that there's any real passion to do something. It's all laid back. Yeah.
But he wants to do something useful, right? To educate people about the history of the propaganda that has been stirring the blacks like this. You know, that would be, you know, educating people about the role of Jews in causing these problems.
Well, there's a lot written about that. There's tons. But we don't have much talent. I don't see much, you know, I don't see much talent in for our interests. There's some talent. Luckily, there's some talent being used in revisionism. But there's not a lot of activity right now. It seems to have quieted down. Everything seems to have quieted down a lot. But I can't, you know, if we're so great, if white, the white race is so great, I don't see a whole, you know, a whole lot of great things being done to look after the white race. So, but I, this is a time for me coming up for to focus on Holocaust and this January 27th anniversary commemoration, which is going to be very big. And I don't, you know, some people would say, well, just let them do their thing and don't try to, you know, make any gains at this time. Or do you do something to try to, because people, see, at this time, here's one reason, at this time, people are paying attention to it because they bring attention to it in the mainstream media. So that's when you can really tear into the truthfulness of what they're saying. And that's when it should be done. But the platforms for doing so are extremely limited.
Yeah, it would be nice if there were some more money coming into this cause. But you know, we do have the Occidental Observer, and we've got a few people doing podcasts. I don't know if anybody's doing radio broadcasts anymore. That was something that the National Alliance pioneered, really. You know, in the 1990s.
Yeah, well, anyway.
But, you know, podcasting on internet is just so much cheaper, and I suppose you can get new listeners for that if you spam.
Well, it's a lot of work if you try, you know, it's one thing to make the podcast. It's another thing to try to get to advertise it, you know, and get people, get it around to a whole lots of people. So other people should be helping with that. And I think there's less being done now, less help, less everything right now than when I first started doing things. It's just must, I don't know exactly the reason for it, but maybe a lot of people have just gotten kind of tired out and there's not enough new ones coming in. But I think, you know, I just think it needs to be something much bigger and more that's going to gain the attention, just like that 10,000-member march in Dresden. It takes something big. You're not going to get anywhere with little podcasts. And there's not very many good podcasts being made now.
I wouldn't think that way. Look,
everybody... I do, because I can't find anything I want to listen to.
Everybody can do something. You know, wherever you are, you can do something.
Well, sure, they can.
You know, that's the way I look at it. As long as I'm doing something that's useful.
But not everybody is doing something.
Yeah, well,
everybody's not doing something. Well, I'm going to be doing some things about. Some interesting. Oh, I'll just say I ordered my 23andMe genetic test and kit. You know, it should be coming in a few days, and
yeah.
I'm going to take that. I'm doing that. I've always wanted to, but I never did it. And now for health, I was talking with some groups about some new things I was connected myself with. About some health things, and they recommended this because it gives you a lot of information, all this genetic information about your, you know, your genes and stuff, and what you're prone to and all. So that motivated me, and I've got it. I'm really looking forward to finding out about that. I'd like to do more with my own ancestry and so on. There's a lot of personal things I'd like to do. Which is what I intend to spend more time on in this next year. So
How much does that cost?
$99.
Oh,
not
$100.
No.
$100 would be too much.
It might have been $99.95 or something for all I know. I don't know, but I bought two $99 things on the same day I ordered. What's the other one? It's I can't think what the other one was.
You know, I'll tell you a story. I was there, when I was in a I was in a trade school once, and one of the instructors was from Portugal, and he was sort of coaching us about how to behave in job interviews. He said, when you ask for, when you tell them how much money you want, don't say, $6.99 an hour. That's too Jewish. He said that.
Who said this to you? Who was it?
It was a Portuguese trade school instructor. He was an engineer, actually. He actually said that, and people were like, what?
They didn't even get that, huh?
What?
That was over their head. They didn't even get that he said that.
No, they understood what he meant, but it was just very surprising that this guy did this.
Yeah. Well, you certainly wouldn't.
Too Jewish.
Yeah. Well, good for him. Well, I really enjoyed this book, We Won't See Auschwitz. I'm glad that the fellow, William was it, who sent it to me. I'm glad he did. That was a nice thing. And I never would have read it otherwise. I feel like it got me more anti-Jewish. That's about what it did.
It's surprising that they're able to acknowledge benevolence from non-Jews, because that's how the Jews stick together, by maintaining the idea that everybody's out to get them and that nobody is really their friend. That's why it's very dangerous to be a non-Jewish friend to a Jew, because, if they're like a hardcore Jew, they're going to resent your friendship in the long term.
And they're not going to trust you either. Because it comes across, that they figure sometimes things are good and people act friendly, but you can't trust a goy. A Jew cannot trust a goy. And they imagine
even
full
if they
rock.
Can, they don't want to. That's the thing. They don't want to trust a goy.
That's another part of it.
Distance.
Yeah. Yeah.
They want to keep
that's
that barrier.
Part of it.
And if you try to take that down, they're going to hate you for it. If you try to be too friendly with them. At least with the hardcore Jews, right?
Right. And then, you have to know the difference between those who really – but if they really identify as a Jew, they're kind of stuck with these ideas. It's just those who maybe don't even want to identify with Jews at all. Like, I guess, Gilad Atzmon doesn't. He doesn't want to, but he still talks about Jews all the time. All he talks about, all these Jews talk about are Jewish issues. They can't get out of that. They can't live really as a non-Jew and just forget about Jews. I wish we spent less time talking about Jews. I find myself getting back into it because they're always in the way. But I think, truthfully, we should drop Jews and ignore Jews and talk about ourselves and our own interests and our goals and what we want to do and forget the Jews.
Well, I find it gratifying actually how little original National Socialist literature talks about Jews. You would think, based on Anglo-American war propaganda and Anglo-American histories of the Second World War, you would think that the National Socialists were obsessed with Jews. And when you read the original National Socialist literature, they don't talk about them very much.
Right. And they have all these programs and plans for themselves, and they talk about Germans and what German culture and tradition is and what German people are like. And they're all about themselves, and we've become all about Jews. And Jews
Jews are really a bigger problem in the USA than they ever were in Germany. And that was really the problem for Germany. It wasn't the Jews in Germany that ended up being the big problem for Germany. It was the Jews in the USA that had so much power here.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, those are some good things you've just said. But I don't know that it answers our questions of what approach to take. And I really do think that without a sort of a united approach by what's left of the white race, that we can't make a dent. We have to have some kind of a somewhat united approach. That would take somebody who was so big and impressive and hardworking and energetic and what have you, and intelligent,
organize that. I think we're at a point when a lot of people are having second thoughts about things, and it's probably possible to reach people with explanations that they maybe wouldn't have considered a few years ago.
But you're not going to do it if you say, well, we're not against Jews, and just leave Jews. You know, I said we should leave Jews alone, but I don't mean that we should, accept that they run everything.
You have to be focused on your own good, not on doing harm to the enemy. That's not the focus. Some people get that focus. That ends up being not constructive, especially when a lot of people get that focus on blacks. A lot of people are so focused on
hating,
spitefulness against blacks that they take a certain glee in the idea that blacks are going to be cast out of work and acquire a really third-rate status as a result of illegal immigration. So they're sort of gloating over that. You know, I've encountered that with some white people. And that's not a good attitude. That's not a good attitude. For better or worse, the white people in the USA have, to some degree, a common interest with the blacks in the USA. The thing is, we have to make something out of that.
I know you have that attitude. I can't really go along with that. I think whites need to live with whites, and I think we need to get blacks out.
That's
I know it seems impossible.
We have to deal with the situation that exists, right?
Yeah.
In an ideal world, the blacks would be somewhere else, but that's not the situation right now, and we have to work with the situation that exists.
I suppose I'm an idealist to the extent that I have trouble working with the situation that exists. It's so unacceptable.
A lot of people have that problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm one of them. So I'm hoping that there are people who can do things. I really do hope for that. And I think that something needs to be done, so... I think we need to recognize how close to the end we are. I don't want to talk like that, but this talk about, well, we need all these people because of our aging population. Well, it's true. I don't know if
it's
we need
not
the
really
people.
True. You know,
no, it's not true.
The reason,
but
the
we
reason
do have an
why,
aging population.
Yeah, we just need a lot more government intervention in the economy to deal with a problem like that, but because the problem is not enough consumers for the goods that are produced. That's the problem that you get when there aren't enough young people. So lack of consumption to keep the factories running. And in order to deal with a problem like that, you just need the government to organize the economy and set the rates at which things are going to operate and so forth. It's not really a problem, unless you're going to let things run in a free market way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, maybe we should do. Maybe you can do a program with me on it someday in the new year, and I can just let you do your thing. Or maybe you can do a show of your own. No, I don't know how you see. You might be able to do that with this. Anyway, I'm going to have to end the show now because I've got a lot of editing to do. It'll be forever before I get this thing posted.
One thing we should do if we wanted to have to deal with this low rate among white people is take women out of the workplace. Take women out of the workplace. That's something that Hitler did. And discouraged women from working. and encourage them to get married and have children.
It's a government policy. Doing that, you can't just order. It will never take place. The liberals, the Democrats would never allow it, and probably the Republicans would be afraid of it too.
This is the problem.
You're talking about something that's so. Yeah, well, you're talking about things that are.
This is the problem.
Not,
we have attitudes in the way. We have attitudes. That won't allow solutions to problems.
Well, that's right, and that's what's called, people's, political positions. So they're hardwired there. There's certain things about women that they're not going to allow in this country anymore. The women.
And the reason why we have government intervention in the economy is because the majority of white people are conditioned to the idea that big government equals redistribution from whites to blacks, right? So they have a knee-jerk opposition to that. They can't think that it's anything else. So, we're kind of screwed because of the added assumptions.
It's complicated. We've got so many things we don't like that we'd like to get rid of that you can't, if you try to get rid of one thing by accepting another, then, you're not going to get anywhere. So it's very complicated.
I think Germany has a much more hopeful future than the United States of America.
Well, I sure hope so, because I care an awful lot about there being a Germany. And I think, I was going to say this on this show, this was going too long, though. I think that if Germany goes, the whole white race goes. I think the Germans are the aristocrats of the white race, and they're the only ones that have ever really held things together once the Romans were gone. So... I just think that people should care an awful lot about what happens to Germany and Germans.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Hattie, for calling in, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I've got to figure out if I'm going to... My program automatically goes to my downloads, and I can't get into my downloads, so this is going to be interesting. At least it'll be a blog talk. I'll see you all, ladies and gentlemen, possibly on the 29th, probably now, not on Monday at all, maybe not until the January 1st. So I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year and a good holiday season, and thank you for listening to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Goodbye.